in my opinion, to put a simple answer to your question, there is an epidemic, and I will include myself in that group of adults. And I do get kickback sometimes too, whenever I use the word immature, simply meaning earlier developmental age,
yes,
who are not functioning at that level of maturity.
Welcome to F It, where we unpack the keys to crafting your dream life. I'm Amy Ledeen, your host. From overcoming adversities like adoption, marriage challenges, and battling cancer, I've learned invaluable lessons. Join me weekly as we explore faith, family, forgiveness, food, fitness, and formula for success. Get ready for actionable strategies and inspiring stories from guests. Buckle up for the journey towards your best self. Welcome to F It.
Okay, so today's episode is a long time coming. You know, I started working with the holistic psychologist. Most of you know her by that, but her name is Dr. Nicole LaPera. But she is someone that I started working with in 2019. I was blessed to have an opportunity to work with her in a one-to-one setting before she really exploded on Instagram. So like I said, if you do not know Nicole LaPera, or also known as the holistic psychologist, you have been living under a rock. As you'll see throughout this episode, we dive into everything from emotional immaturity to how to manage triggers and being activated, to everything from why our childhood and the memories of that matter so much. This is a must share episode. So my encouragement to you today is, as you listen to this, first hold space for yourself. There may be some feelings that come up of guilt, shame. You know, I know me being a mother and not always being the best mom, you know, it could be really a slippery slope that I could just go into a shame cycle and feel bad about all the things I didn't do. That is not what this episode is about. This is to be encouraging, to know that it's never too late to become mature in our awakening. So I'm excited for you to listen in on this episode with me and Dr. Nicole LaPera. I am so excited to have you on here today. I know this is a long time coming. So welcome officially to the podcast.
Thank you, Amy, for having me. I too have been waiting a long time for this moment.
I looked back in my email and it was 2019 when I reached out to you and, you know, thought that it was my cancer and everything around that that I needed help with, not realizing that I'd never really dove into anything related to my own mental health. I had done what I call surface therapy. And I think that's what the majority of people are still, you know, a part of, is this traditional therapy, you know, talk, right?
Yeah, I think your story really is emblematic. I think it takes something in life that might inspire us to look at things on a deeper level. Though I think when we do that, we do discover the depth, to speak to your point, that's beneath even the surface, know, kind of
totally.
Issue, struggle, whatever it was that inspired us to seek whatever support it is that we're seeking.
Well, and initially, you know, you'd sent me the intake forms. I actually printed them off today because I was like, this alone is an exercise that I actually think everyone needs to do. I remember getting it thinking, whoa, this is a lot of information. No one in all of my history. And I mean, you know, I'd gone through an adoption placement, you know, an affair. So I've been through a lot of therapy and no one had ever asked me about my childhood. No one had, you know, just asked me. I mean, let me just read a couple of these questions in here. And it was like, what were your problems? What were problems for you as a child? Did you have intimate close friends during childhood? Do you have intimate close friends now? You know, how would you describe your mother's discipline? You know, how would you describe your discipline as a child? Like, were you ever spanked or punished? And it brought up, you know, I remember filling these out going, wow, you know, I ran away as a six-year-old. That can't be normal. I had never thought about that until then. Why do you think so many people miss out on this piece in therapy?
It's wild, because even as you're saying it, and I'm recollecting my process of creating now this intake form, and even just thinking of my clinical training where, and I imagine a lot of clinicians believe this true, like I had the instinctual knowledge, our childhood impacts us. I mean, I went through the psychoanalytic path, which is very Freudian, right? All of these kind of deeper issues that originate in childhood and how they carry us forward. Yet, when I really thought about the practical application, even in my own practice, prior to, of course, the work you and I began, I'm talking about kind of traditionally, there was no diving in, exploration. It was kind of like, we knew that, but we didn't necessarily know, I think, to the depth that we know now in terms of, it's not just that our childhood impacts us in theory. I've really started to understand the depth of impact wired into our body, our nervous system reactions, and then ultimately how it continues to show up in our life. So saying to say, I'm not sure, because again, I think a lot of us clinicians, clinically trained folk do know to some extent that the childhood is of impact, but I think without the more holistic or integrative awareness, and for me, that was all new scientific information, learning about the nervous system, learning about the body even more generally before I got to the nervous system and then the heart and then the importance of attachment down to this foundational level. And again, without that scientific information, that scientific knowledge, and then the ability to apply that within client work, I think that was the missing piece. We didn't truly have, and we're still learning the language of its impact.
Wow. Well, and I, you know, in your first book, you talked about like how, you know, you went through a holistic approach. You were, that was like what was new and kind of even what separated you. I mean, again, even on these intake forms, you asked me about my diet. I thought I was taking a nutrition intake here. I mean, honestly, because again, people are not getting to the root, and even you encouraging certain foods for me, you know, to eat that it would help me. And I just had never made that connection. And being a nutritionist, I was like, wow, how could I not see this connection? So when you started, where, I know that you mentioned in your book, but those of you that haven't read the book yet, where did you start with first when you were like, I need to work on myself? And instead of like the talk therapy traditional, where did you start?
For me, the biggest awakening outside of all of this information, even interesting hearing you bring up nutrition, because I think that's another field where the knowledge is incomplete. I mean, even some of the curriculum that nutritionists or medical professionals are taught around what is healthy, quote unquote, food to eat is, in my opinion, quite different from, I believe, what the human body ultimately needs. So I had all of this information, and my first foundational step was beginning trying to think of, okay, well, how am I going to apply this information? Right now, I had some lifestyle choices, for lack of a better word. I could start to eat better, sleep better, manage my stress better. Though for me, what became foundationally apparent to me was how disconnected I was. I could have all of these beautiful plans, and I'd worked with many clients traditionally who had a lot of insight, right? A lot of wanting to do better, the know-how to do better. But what was missing was the ability to build that bridge or to translate that information into action. And I saw the same in myself. And when I really kind of sought to understand, well, why is it that many of us struggle to change, right? Why can we know what we want to do differently? Even for me, why can I now know all of this information? Why am I struggling to apply it? And for me, that was clear. The reason why I, and I think many of us are struggling to apply it, is we're not showing up as the incredibly empowered, conscious being, a creator of our current moment that we truly are. And what we're typically kind of allowing to run our life is that autopilot, I think, that many of us are common knowledge. And for me, that was so true. I was living life so disconnected, so reliant on those early habits and patterns that I created in an environment where I was consistently emotionally overwhelmed. So that disconnection, I think, that many of us experience in life, that reliance on that autopilot has become a protection, because yes, there is so much overwhelming trauma experience, you know, things that we haven't yet processed because we haven't been given the tools, many of us from generations who haven't had the tools themselves. So really simply, and you'll always then hear me use this same framework when I talk about any of us creating change, because without that conscious presence, without us showing up in a moment when that autopilot knows what it's going to do, right? And showing up in that moment and saying, no, I'm going to make a new choice, even if it's creating a new lifestyle habit, like eating a different food, that is that first step that we have to take before then we can begin to make new choices that will help us to be more regulated in our body or more regulated in our relationships.
I like that. And I see, you know, the food part for me, my own journey, it's twofold, because once I started going through, you know, your book and then through the member circle, I had a lot of healing that I needed to do. So I was a child that
I really raised myself. My parents were entrepreneurs. They were gone from the house. So from a young age, I was cooking for myself. I was, you know, doing everything. As an adult, I found this resentment towards meal prep, towards making anything for me. And it wasn't until I reconnected and saw, Amy, this is the ultimate form of self-love. So that it was like, not only is the food I'm choosing is really important, but the act of going to my kitchen. And once I started to reframe that, it was so much easier for me not to be this little seven-year-old having a tantrum, because I still have it rear its ugly head where I'm like, what about me? Who's going to take care of me? No one ever took care of me. I get very jealous. I get sometimes triggered when I see husbands that are like, oh, I'm going to, you know, I never had that. Or like people that just talk about their childhood where they're like, oh, my mom had cookies waiting for us when we got home. It's like 7-year-old comes out and she's like, I never got that. Right. And so flipping that and changing it in what I can do for her has been so empowering. Do you find that that's the case with a lot of people, is trying to reconnect that with their childhood?
I think, and I appreciate you sharing the underlying feelings of anger, right? Of even resentment, right? Of, because I really want to just take a moment to pause for listeners to validate before we get to, right, the step of how to care, which you very much beautifully empowered yourself to take, because that's real. The reason you're feeling anger is completely understandable, because at your core, those needs left completely alone, your physical needs for care, your emotional needs for support were unmet. And anger is the natural byproduct when either our needs are unmet, and typically for a long period of time, and or when our boundaries are violated. And I'm pausing here because I think a lot of us, we either blow by that, right? We think, or we shame ourselves for that upset in the moment where we're throwing that adult-sized tantrum saying, I don't want it. And I can tell you, I have a million I don't want to type tantrums. That emotion is real, right? And so until we allow ourselves to then not only just say, okay, I know why I'm mad because these needs weren't met, to be present with that anger, to allow that anger to be valid, and to then allow ourselves to process that anger in a new way, which then I think becomes that beautiful empowerment step, which is, okay, well, now I can begin to care for myself. And I see this patterning and this level of awareness. I really appreciate you sharing, because I think it can be really counterintuitive, because I, in similar ways, had gone with my emotional needs unmet. And so whether it's emotional or physical needs that are unmet, right? We have this anger, we have this resentment, we might empower ourselves to meet our needs, and yet we're still interpersonal beings. Mm-hmm. Many of us are still in relationship. And the point, in my opinion, right, of relationship is for this exchange of support, sometimes of objective type support. So saying that to say, these conflicts within us, at least in my own self, and I think this can resonate with a lot of you, sometimes then lead us in moments to feel the need for support, but to feel so threatened, so afraid to tell people, right? So now we're even at odds with our human nature, a person in need of support, because the reality for a lot of us was that's so foreign, that's so unfamiliar. Maybe putting ourselves out there didn't end with the support that we needed. It might have ended with us being denied support or being shamed or maybe even being abused. So, and I share that because these deep-rooted conflicts don't just go away as we become aware, even as we begin to take steps to self-care, because I know that there's a lot of us, myself included, we can get some traction with, okay, I'm understanding how to care for myself and my body. But when it goes to asking someone else for the support that I need, that's where, right, the depth of this wounding comes up, because some of us feel too vulnerable to even say we need the support. We expect other people to mind read just to know. And then that causes conflict, of course, when they don't just know in our relationship, and now we're in conflict with them instead of, right, the deeper issue.
Totally.
Or we ask for support and we make it so hard. I like to paint a picture of kind of, I put my hand out in front of me with like daggers on it and I'm begging for a hug, right? And it's like, who in their right mind would come hug me in this moment, right? So now I've created an environment where I might be saying, I need you, but I'm making it so intolerable, maybe even abusive for you to be around me because I'm being mean. Mm-hmm. Why would you then give me the support? So I just wanted to paint all of, I think, the levels of conflict and healing and unpacking that doesn't just go away when we understand what happened, right? This is, I think, the conversation we're going into is the embodiment now of creating change, which for a lot of us even puts us at odds with what we truly want and even with what we truly need in any given moment.
Wow. And that actually leads right into kind of what I was like, you know, if there's one topic I wanted to really dive in with you, it was emotional immaturity. Because when I watch a lot of your skits, you know, and it's sometimes a hard pill to swallow, because, you know, my daughter, my 21-year-old, she's read all your stuff. She's going through all of it. So she'll tag me, you know, and stuff. And sometimes I'm like, oh my gosh, this was me, you know, 7 years ago. I mean, not even that long ago, right? But I mean, the beauty of her going through it, and I would even say to anyone that has children, my children's age, get them in the work, because the empathy that she now has for me has become so great that she understands, like, I also was this immature person that just was doing the best I could with what I knew how, you know. But it's really, I think, a place that we have most of us walking around with emotional immaturity. And it almost triggers people when I say that. They don't even, when I recommend the book, because it's like one of my, you know, right next to yours, I'm always like, this is the first book Nicole had me read. And, you know, I did the Audible, and there's so many stories in there that I'm like, yep, it was first me blaming my parents. I thought, oh, this is going to make me feel so good about myself because my parents are emotionally immature. When really I learned that's me too, because behaviors are caught. They're not just taught, right? So I caught a lot of we don't respond to conflict. We just bury it. We don't talk about it. We, you know, all of those things that I didn't realize there were actual tools and help for us to get over this emotional immaturity. Do you feel that that's a big issue for most people walking around?
When we talk about emotional immaturity, we have to understand that our ability, and this was a new piece of understanding for me much later in my career, the ability to tend to our emotions isn't innate. And what I mean when I say that is, as a human infant, we are born not only in a state of dependency, meaning we can't physiologically care for ourselves, we can't physically keep ourselves alive, we need a caregiver. We're also born with an underdeveloped nervous system, which means that we can't regulate. And human infant, and those of you who have had one, you know, in the past, have very upfront experience with, right, when an infant cries and becomes dysregulated. And this is even, Amy, counter to parenting advice that I don't even know up to what year it was given, this idea of cry it out, right, that children can. And a lot of us, I believe, were children of that generation where this language wasn't used. And of course, it was, in my opinion, no ill intent of these past, you know, parenting professionals. It was the lack of information that I was describing earlier, because in reality, children cannot soothe themselves. Their nervous system is incapable of it. So now let's apply this to the conversation around emotions, right? Our ability to then soothe and be with and be present and tolerate and have a mature relationship with our emotions, which in my opinion looks like being present to what's happening emotionally. And just to be clear, a new definition maybe for some of you, emotions just aren't concepts in my mind, right? Emotions are mapped onto physiological shifts and changes, sensory changes in my body, right? So the ability to be emotionally mature, maybe we define that now, is to be present to what's happening emotionally, which is whether or not we did come from the family that shoves it all underneath the rug is happening for many of us outside of our awareness, because those emotions, those shifts and changes in our body are essentially our body's interface between us and how we're experiencing the world around us. Simply, they were registering our experience. So then that becomes, these emotions, an important guidepost for us. They're giving us information. And again, whether or not you're like me, living in what I call my spaceship, a million miles away from this body. So you could have told me emotions are happening, but I would have felt more or less numb to them for a while, or just completely overwhelmed that I couldn't even, you know, kind of engage with what was in there. But to be emotionally mature, right, we have to be present to them. We have to learn how to navigate or to tolerate or to cope with them in a way that's functional, right? That's not harming ourselves or harming other people.
Right.
And then to be emotionally mature within a relationship, we have to expand our awareness to the reality that we might not always share the same emotional experience with someone else. So can we, in those moments, then hold space for really simply how I'm feeling and how you're feeling? So this multi-step process is a process. that many of us do not and did not have the resources that we needed, which was in the form of the caretakers,
right,
who were able to do it themselves. Again, because of advice maybe they had learned or their parents had learned,
right,
maybe because of points of access or inaccess to resources, to support, to finances, to a million other things that prevented them as individuals from being able to navigate their own emotional world in this way. So then right. The natural byproduct, like you beautifully said, is then they can't show up no matter how well-intentioned they are, no matter how much they, as many do, affirm to themselves that they are never going to create that past for their own children. They can only model, especially in those emotionally dysregulated moments, what they themselves can do. So in my opinion, to put a simple answer to your question, there is an epidemic, and I will be include myself in that group of adults. And I do get kickback sometimes too, whenever I use the word immature, simply meaning earlier developmental age,
yes,
who are not functioning at that level of maturity. And again, this is another, you know, kind of reasoning beyond awareness. We can say and not criticize ourselves now for those emotionally immature moments. And this is why I share all of this behind the scenes physiology in hopes of relieving maybe the shame that many of us are carrying around as we're betraying ourselves, as we're harming those we love. But again, I want to emphasize, awareness is the first step. Relieving that shame is so important because we all are human and we all are going to be constrained by that which we were taught, though that next step of embodying new tools, of learning now as an adult without shame, how to regulate our nervous system, how to reach out for those co-regulative moments of support that we need.
Right.
That is the job then. And of course, it's not shame-based, but it really, I think, is emblematic of the many adults who didn't have that teaching and who now, and this is why, you know, even the subtitle of my book, Break Cycles, I think this is why so many of us can look, you know, back at our lineages and see similar types of coping. Because totally. The large majority of us have struggled for generations to develop this skill.
100%. And you see it in the modeling, you know, my youngest daughter, and no two children are alike, you know, my youngest daughter obviously saw a lot of me hiding my emotion. Cause when she gets emotional, she wants to hide. She wants to go in a room. She doesn't like to let anyone see her cry. I never taught her that. That's something she saw from me, that I never was vulnerable enough to cry in front of her and say, hey, I'm having a hard day. And you know what? It's okay. Mommy's crying. And I didn't do that because my parents never showed that. In fact, my parents said it was a sign of weakness, you know, so we should not show that. Anytime I did cry as a kid, it was like, dry it up. Like those were the words, dry it up. You're okay. You're not dying and you're not bleeding. Or that was usually like the response. And so it was like, hide those emotions, you know? So I think, you know, it's anyone listening to this too, you know, seeing the patterns even in your own children kind of speaks to you, in as much as that's hard to hear, because they're modeling it somewhere, right?
And I think that's why, I mean, I have so much respect for each and every human who is in any sort of care of a child, of a developing human, because it is so challenging. I mean, to be that source, as I just described, of everything, of physical needs, of emotional needs. And so I want to, as we're kind of diving down this, emphasize for parents who are listening, perfection is not the goal here. There is now extensive research in terms of, right, attunement. That's what we're talking about. Being able to know when a child is dysregulated, and then being able to some extent, mind read, right? This is the task of a parent. A child can't verbalize what's happening,
right?
So it is the parent's job to attuning to the nonverbal cues to figure out, oh, is my child hungry in this moment? Is it, you know, is it just upset and agitated? Is it uncomfortable? What soothing is needed, right? And that level of attunement, right, is so incredibly important, and the task of doing that. So I really want to emphasize again for parents that it is not perfection. It is impossible for you to be perfectly attuned to the children that you're in care of. And I want to say somewhere the statistic is, I don't want to be misquoted, but have the idea it's around like 30 to 40% of the time. It's much lower than I think maybe we would imagine. Meaning, right, we can't always, we're not always going to, though what is so important is not those moments of disconnection where for whatever reason, you don't know what it is right. that is wanted or needed, or you're not able to give what exactly is wanted or needed because you don't have the resources yourself in that moment. You're running on little sleep. You have something emotionally happening. What right. is most important is not necessarily those moments of disconnection, but what happens on the other side. And this kind of just brings to mind this crying example too, because I think a lot of parents have this idea, right, that emotion, right, might overwhelm a child by showing that a parent has emotion. Mm-hmm. Or another idea I think a lot of parents have by admitting when a parent, you know, acted in a way that was maybe disconnected or was not ideal in that moment. I think a lot of parents have this idea that it's problematic for accountability to be taken, for that acknowledgement.
Right.
And that is so healing. What we're talking about now is the repair, the reconnection. Right. Right. The parent who, when they do have their resources available to them, is able to return to the child and to reconnect. And of course, then given the age of the child, is maybe able to have a conversation, take totally. Responsibility, give language to what the child saw and experienced, because what's happening in the child's mind is they're trying to figure it out.
Right.
Right. And with that immature, again, just early developmental stage level of maturity and awareness, the narrative that they might land on, as many of us had in our own childhood, might not only be accurate, it likely will implicate them as a cause for what happened. And that is, I think, why so many of us have these deep-rooted ideas that we are the cause of whether it's someone else's, you know, behaviors, emotions, whether we just feel so unworthy at our core that we're the cause of everything bad or negative that has happened in our life. And of course, I'm generalizing right. a lot of the outcomes, but I just want to illustrate, of course, from us as parents, I want to celebrate and honor the role of parenting. Because again, modeling, parents can try and say and read the right books and deliver the right script in the moment, but it's what is felt. And again, perfection is not possible. It's not the goal here. What needs to be felt is that authenticity, those mm-hmm. true moments of a parent saying, you know, I am sad. Sadness is a natural part of the human experience. Here's what sadness looks like for me. And then not to even project that that must be what sadness looks like for you, to right. then open up an exploration now in tandem with a child to explore what sadness is for them, what provokes it, what helps them feel comforted when they're sad. And of course, now we can apply this to any emotion. And now mm-hmm. what a child is having the experience of, unlike the many of us who are crying in our room alone, now they have an experience of presence. Because right. the reality of it is that's what most of us want and are seeking, because we know people can't solve our problems. Many of us, when we go to another sharing what's coming up for us emotionally, we're not looking for the objective solution. What we're looking for is this beautiful space of presence that we're now going to model for our children. And if you remember, that was even one of the definitions I gave of emotional maturity. So now in action, we're teaching that, whether because we're showing ourselves going through that, or whether or not because we're showing ourselves alongside of, and we're kind of, I should say, joining our child in their own process of self-discovery in terms of their own emotional world.
I love that. And it's never too late. I mean, I've got older children than obviously are younger. And about, you know, when I started working with you, it was my awakening where we took our kids on a vacation and we sat down with them. And I just was extremely open that I was finally awake and aware of some of the patterns and behaviors and how I wanted to help them work through it. What I also learned too is no two kids see, they don't view their childhood the same. So just this last year, we went on a vacation and my two older kids, they got into a little bit of a fight. And next thing you know, I mean, my oldest is triggered and I mean, we're like having this massive family fight. And it was, I mean, thank goodness I've been through a lot of this work where I was able to just listen to him instead of being defensive. Cause I'm like, your childhood wasn't like that. And how could you, that would have been the old me. Like, you are so lucky and you're going to sit here and say this. I just sat there and I just let him listen. You know, I called his dad and I said, so here's the thing, when, you know, Kai comes to you to talk about this, just listen to him. Because while I don't feel like that was the childhood I thought I gave him,
He obviously is seeing it this way, and I need to at least validate that first, because the old me would have just dismissed it, which is what happened most of my life. And then I think it makes people question their own reality. Can you talk a little bit about what the effect that has on when people don't, they have to deny their own reality?
I want to just talk really quickly about reality for a second, because I think this is one of those concepts, right, that's so elusive. And I think some of us have this idea that there is an objective reality, that all of us can stand in a room like you're describing, right, with your children, and we can all agree, right, the narration of childhood, the story, and we've all experienced it the same way. And so thank you for illustrating how inaccurate that is, because we are actively, in a lot of ways, constructing our reality by the meaning that we're making of it, by the fact that we are different, and we differ in terms of our energetic sensitivity in our bodies. We're all energetically sensitive creatures, but of course we all have different limits, or things register differently. And then of course all of this contributes, because it is the sensations in our body and the stories running through our mind that contribute to then our experiences, which is why, similar to your kind of family iteration, coming from having two very older siblings, 18 and 15 years older than me when I was born, wow, it was very confusing. Because when we are having experience of reality, and when we're hearing from someone else at any point in our development, when it's happening, but that's not what's happening, or later, like you're describing, when we're being told what one's experience was of a past event or a past childhood, and we're now being denied, it's very confusing, especially for a child. Because again, in that state of dependency, we will deny our reality in service of the reality that's going to keep us connected to the caregiver on whom we're reliant for our survival. And then the more consistently that happens, so for me, a lot of moments of being told this childhood, this narration, especially around a relationship with mom, right? Hearing how my brother and my sister made sense of an experienced relationship with mom, and then having my experience of my relationship with mom and it not matching, but needing to, you know, assume that reality of the family unit, before long, the byproduct, then to answer your question, is we develop an inability to trust ourselves, our perception of reality. Some of us don't know what it is, or we might have a sense of what we think it is, but we don't feel confident speaking it to someone else.
Yes.
And then the second we do speak it to someone else, if we get any indication that they don't immediately agree, then we go into, again, a state of shaming or denying. So we lack the trust and the ability to acknowledge or even explore our own reality without kind of having that litmus test of what someone else thinks.
And that's so important, because I think of like my childhood and just the lying, you know, lying to get love. And, you know, I approached it completely different with my older kids. The first time they lied, I was like, this is, you know, I mean, discipline crazy. When my youngest lied for the first time a couple of years ago, I reflected on what in our relationship is making her feel like she cannot come to me and trust me. And that was such a flip in my life, because it was like, I could either take this and just totally discipline her and, you know, punish her, whatever, or I could go, honey, are you not feeling safe in telling me the truth here? Is there something that is making you feel like I would punish you? Let's talk through it even logically. What have I ever, you know, in the past when you've gotten in trouble, let's talk about that. And like, what happened in that case? A lot of times it's like a false reality. Like, I mean, when I talk to her, she goes, I don't know. I go, have we ever really punished you? Have you ever been spanked? She's like, no. I go, okay, so let's explore this more, and that I want you to feel like this is a safe place. But it wasn't until I actually started to see a lot of your skits on the lying or the posts on lying that I'm like, wow, I've been approaching this completely wrong, right?
And that's such a responsible and powerful shift to make, right? Is that we are creating a climate that either, and we can apply this outside of even children, romantic partners, loved ones, friendships that we want to deepen, right? If we want truth and honest connection from whomever it is, we are, it's not just a matter of, well, do they know themselves enough to then be honest with me? It's what role are we playing in creating that climate? And just even looking back at my own childhood, there was so much secrecy. And I would get teased to some extent in my family with like, Nicole's so secret. She's so, no one ever tells us anything. And this was being compared to my older sister, who had a much different relationship with my mom, who more or less told her everything, even things that I think were inappropriate that my mom then co-signed. But that's another story in and of itself. But right. So now I'm being compared. So now I am for a long time wondering, well, what is wrong with me? Why am I so secretive? You know, why do I have this alternate life that my parents couldn't even imagine and would die if they knew? And then I then saw played out. And this was a moment of like, whoa. When my nephew, my sister then had a child, and he's now 17 years old. And so he was much younger. I think he was around 6, and he just started getting caught lying. And I remember in an uproar, my mom and sister kind of came to me like, you know, he's a liar, Nicole. What are we going to do? He's a liar, you know? And I just remembered having this moment of like, oh my gosh, like here it is again. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, and it's not that, and even that label, he's a liar. You know, and like, no, like what is causing, and the way you're thinking about it is so beautiful, Amy. What is causing whoever it is that's not telling us the truth to feel unsafe? And to speak to your point, sometimes it's the climate we're co-creating, right? Sometimes it's their own, if it's an adult, of course, their own past experience that then they're projecting on, even if it's not necessarily how we're showing up. But just to finish the story of my nephew and give my sister credit, at this point now in his 17, I am shocked at the amount that he shares with her, because the work that she has done, and I just want to take a moment to celebrate that, especially to acknowledge, like you are doing, the change that can happen in the years as a parent becomes aware and creates an environment where they can hear without reacting, even if they disagree, right, and explore then those points of disagreement, can create a climate that now I've evidenced, and even in my own family, where I'm like, oh, you guys are talking about that. I would, ooh, you know, wow, how nice that he now has, right, you in support of these aspects of his life that I would have never in a million years spoken to my family. So I was shy, again, not because that's who I was. I was shy and withholding because I didn't feel safe, because anytime something came out, my mom would near immediately go into, understandably, her own dysregulated emotional cycle that then I would feel responsible for, that for many years kept me from sharing anything with anyone, because I felt that responsibility. I caused people to be upset, my thoughts, my emotions, my needs. So I'm just not going to share any of it, not to upset those people that I care about or want to stay connected to.
Wow. Hearing that, I'm like, okay, that's another one I'll keep working on, because I see it. So let's talk about, because two of the tools that you have, I mean, that have really helped me is future self journaling. I'm still a big, I mean, I make all my clients future self journal. I think it's super, super important. And I think some people make the mistake of forgetting that it's a journey and that it takes time. So I always give the example of I was an overreactor. I don't like to label myself anymore, but my emotional immaturity, I would fly off the handle too quickly. And really it was just wanting my needs met, right? So I started the future self journaling. And, you know, I always say tension is the test. Unfortunately, with the future self journaling, you're not going to know until you're in that situation if it's kind of working, right? Because you're hoping to have some rewiring, and that now when you're in the situation, I'm going to go towards what I've written down and I'm wiring myself to do. Can't say it always happens. You know, I just recently was on a vacation and it was crazy. You know, I'm thankful that I didn't go to the shame place. But, you know, when you've put in a lot of work, sometimes it's hard not to feel like, I still can't get it together. You know, Eric had gone out I was sick. So he went out to dinner by himself, which I was so happy. You know, honestly, like my best self was like, good, please go get something to dinner. I'm stuck in the hotel room, upset. Well, when he came back, I don't know if it's like he didn't give me attention quick enough or whatever. I literally picked a fight with him. And luckily he was able to see it, so it didn't escalate. You know, that's important why your partner has to do some of the work too, because that could have triggered him, which would have caused a fight. Instead, he was like, honey, let's talk through this. Like, I know that you are not truly feeling this way. Do you just need my attention right now? And I was like a little 5-year-old, so embarrassed that I, you know, was like that. But I don't think a lot of people have those, you know, tools. Do you feel like the future self journal is something that everyone can benefit from starting at any point?
I think that, yes. And I want to preface that though with, similarly to, I think what you're saying here beautifully, Amy, is it's not a magic journal, right? I kind of have this visual of kind of like Harry Potter-esque, right? Closing it, kind of like, oh, you know, stars aligning and now poof, I am that person. So this even goes back to those two stages, very simplified stages of change, awareness,
right,
and action. So The Future Self Journal, I absolutely, and for me as someone who never, and probably not surprised to hear, as I'm someone who wasn't connected to my emotions and didn't feel safe expressing them. So I was never going to Dear Diary free right. associate. So journaling was never a part, because I just want to share this, because I think anytime we hear journal, for me at least, I would immediately, oh, that's not for me. So when I though start to learn about rewiring and neuroscience, and again, how deep these habits went and how powerful this autopilot was, I started to explore, well, is there some practical then way I can integrate some version of a journaling practice to help me create change? And what I then came up with was Future Self Journaling. And I feel it's helpful, again, for all of us, because for a lot of us, it's that point in our day, whether it's in the morning, the afternoon, the evening, right, where we're putting pen to paper, where we're in that conscious state of awareness, where we're setting and envisioning, right, writing in the present tense as if it's already the case, the new way we want to show up, right? Using the new awareness of what now I want to do differently, what new habit I want to create in my life or whatever it is. And I'm writing in the present tense. So I'm already starting in that conscious, present, attentional state, right? Where all change is possible, to lay down some new neural networks. I'm almost practicing. Right. I want to emphasize the practice. Right. Because again, when I put that journal now away, what happens for a lot of us, and I see the same thing with people who have a much more what I would call a traditional meditation practice, right? This idea of sitting alone in a dark room, eyes closed, because I'm of the belief that any moment can be made in meditation if we're in that conscious state of awareness,
yes,
which is the important step to build that bridge, right? Because if I leave my meditation cushion, if I leave my future self journal, if I close the door of that room, if you will, and if I then just go out and let autopilot take me through life, then what I'm going to, even though I strengthened somewhat of a new neural network in the beginning of the day, what I'm strengthening for the rest of the day is that autopilot. So for a lot of us, that reminder in the morning, that maybe reminder then that we set throughout our day to initiate that new action begins that bridge and makes it a little more accessible in the moment. Because now that I'm even saying the word accessible, I'm just throwing a little science in here quickly. As we're becoming stressed, which is a lot of the moments that we want to create change in, right? As we're even doing something new, which naturally stresses our nervous system, the more stressed we become and the more then reliant we are on what I'm going to simplify and call our emotional brain, the more we're losing access to that very powerful conscious state of awareness that created that intention, which is why in those moments, we even kind of somewhat forget. Right? It's not top of mind.
Yes.
And that's why it feels so shameful, because after the fact, but I wanted to explain the neurology, if you will, neuroscience, because the reality of it is the more stressed and emotional our brain is firing, the less access we have. So it's not, it's natural is what I want to say. It's natural to fall off new habits because the stress of even positive change is stressing our nervous system. So many of us revert right back to those old habits.
Right.
So learning again, that stress, that change, that the more stressed I become, the less likely I am to be able to execute this new practice. It's not shameful. It's just, again, more evidence that I need to continue to teach not only my mind, but my body how to deal with stress, even stress that's moving me in the positive direction. Because again, to my body, it's still registering stress.
And that's just, I think that's where a lot of your self-soothing, even like the rocking back and forth, hugging myself.
Buddy, I was kind of just doing that right now. I don't know if you noticed me when I was like talking.
I never would have even considered. And now it, because even the future self journaling, I put specific tactics that I say I'm going to do. Hey, it may not happen 5 out of 10 times, but those other 5, the more I'm writing it, I find that it happens. So I have a question for you. And I thought this, maybe we could even put an applicable way of writing out a future self journal. So we were on vacation with some friends a while back, and she comes from a, you know, traumatic childhood. Her mother was an alcoholic, and you know, she brings all that baggage into the relationship. So we're on vacation with them. Her husband is having a few drinks. Keep in mind, she's totally okay with him having drinks. But it's like playing Russian roulette. You might get a trigger at one point or another with her, right? And so just so happens that night, I guess she just didn't like, and she didn't even remember like what caused the trigger. But next thing you know, she's mad at her husband. She's like, what? You know, you're drinking and getting all mad. I mean, this like escalated so fast. The next day we see them, she's full of shame. You know, she feels awful for the way that she's treated him. And, you know, of course I was like, okay, future self journal right here would have been a great practice. It may have not solved last night, but again, that wiring, how would someone go about writing out, like, give me an example of what would be a great thing that she could start to write in her future self journal to help her start to become aware?
I think when we're talking about awareness, and I can even answer this maybe in a way that can apply to anyone in a situation, you know, when we're talking about maintaining awareness, let me word it this way, what we, and again, applying our body and the stress reaction that's happening, right? That moment of kind of fugue state is real, right? Not remembering the trigger, right? Getting so emotionally overwhelmed again by that limbic system, the emotional brain, and then feeling shameful afterward. What that to me, if we want to give it again, the neuroscientific language, our nervous system, right, became stressed to a point of overwhelm. And then our habitual reaction for her, right, what it was yelling in fight for some of us, it's dissociating or disconnecting, running away, whatever it is, right now that took over. So I think the important and perhaps the journaling prompt practice is knowing the awareness that we can increase, because we all have different tolerance points, right? Stress increases, is activated. Even like you said, we become triggered. Just a matter of time. We don't know, right? What is important is to become aware of our body as it's escalating in stress before we get to what we could call the point of no return, right? So the awareness, I think, that can be foundationally helpful for anyone in any circumstance of, right, I become overwhelmed, I become triggered, and then I become reactive, whatever my flavor is, and I want to break that habit. I think the foundational practice is, can I become conscious throughout my day in terms of shifts and changes in my body's stress system? And three areas that we have access to at any point in our day, even in a moment now, as I'm talking, maybe listeners want to do a quick scan, we can assess or just pay attention to our muscles. Are they tense? Do they feel, you know, kind of active and ready to action? Are they weak? We can also pay attention to our breathing, right? Are we holding our breath? Same. I catch myself holding my breath a lot.
If I'm holding it, I know something's either going to be coming. And that's like my first trigger response.
Bracing, right? It's like we're holding our breath, waiting, bracing. Mm-hmm. Are we almost like heaving? Is our breath kind of, can we not catch our breath? I think that's another experience we might tune into. Or is our breath calm, regular, right? Coming from our belly, very grounded. And then our breath and our heart rate, you know, and all of these systems and our muscles are very connected. So can we tune in? Is our heart racing right out of our chest? You know, is our heart so imperceptible because we're barely even in our body? Or do we tuned in? Can I say, okay, I can more or less feel my heart beating right now? And so those systems are the systems that will register changes in stress. So the more we're attentive, and again, this isn't, as I say, like a light switch. We don't just check in once and be like, oh, I did my stress assessment for the day.
Right.
The more consistently we can pay attention. So even as you asked me in the beginning, what did I begin with? For me, it was a foundational conscious practice. Can I pay attention to myself and my body throughout the day so that then I can build that practice onto that practice and say, okay, can I now pay attention to my body as it's reacting to stress?
Totally.
So that before I go over that point of no return, the habitual reaction takes over. I feel shameful on the other side because I hurt myself or someone else. Now in those moments, I can begin to make more intentional choices. So just to, again, apply this conversation to your friend, right? As the conversation at dinner is happening, as maybe she is feeling tension increasing, her heart begin to increase, maybe she's starting to hold her breath or starting to, you know, breathe really heavily or labored. In those moments, a choice can be made to intentionally either regulate self in moment, not leaving, right? If we can do some deep belly breathing, maybe we can't. Maybe we need to take a step away. Maybe it's to the bathroom to take some deep breaths in there, maybe take a quick walk around the restaurant and then come back.
Yes.
Or maybe it's just too overwhelming and we have to then leave the experience of dinner. But what we've now done, we've put ourselves in the empowered seat. It doesn't now matter how many drinks, right, husband has or how he's reacting or behaving in that moment, because I have a direct connection to how I'm experiencing it. And then I have a direct opportunity to shift and change how I'm experiencing it in a way that allows me to stay regulated so that I don't then do the shameful thing. Now, of course, just to play this tape forward, does it maybe mean that a conversation the next day, of course, if something abusive or violating might have happened, can happen, but in the moment when we're activated, which is in the moment when we want to try to have that conversation, especially whether or not it's we're activated or our partner. So going back to something beautiful you said earlier, Amy, too, the more we know our partner, the more we know their kind of triggers, the more we know their, and I spend a lot of time in my book, not just talking about how to assess our own stress, how to assess other people's stress cues, the more we're able to set ourselves up to navigate these moments in a much more grounded way. And then to be able to address the things, because some of us dive right in. We want to have the conversation when we want to have it, when we're dysregulated, or maybe we're calm and they're dysregulated. Yes. And they aren't the times, because again, we're going to be in that emotional brain, whether it's us or them. And before long, that's why these conflict cycles happen.
Totally. We called it our fight dance, and we had to learn how to fix the fight dance, because Eric was the solver. He wants to get to the bottom of it. No matter how long it's going to take us tonight, we're going to talk it out. I'm the opposite in that once I am already at a state, there's nothing you're going to get out of me. I will shut down. I actually even need to kind of either sleep on it, or now I'm able, if it's midday, I can do some breath work and things like that. But otherwise, we were getting nowhere. Now, because we've had these conversations in a calm time, I think that's also important. You can't wait until you're fighting and be like, this does not work for me. Now Eric knows when I'm like, you know what, I'm too activated. He's like, all right, let's take a break here, because we know that, right? And then I think it's also important to remember with the practice, if you have a big, you know, a history of a lot of, you know, things that are coming up, it's going to take more than one time in a day. You had me start doing like a 2 p.m., you know, kind of connect with myself again, where you're like, Amy, obviously you're starting strong in the day, and I'm future self journaling. I'm doing all my things. By 2 in the afternoon, I'm right back on autopilot. I'm back in my fear state with my cancer, you know, with all of those things, not realizing, you know, I call them software updates, where I need more. My system is really damaged. And so the degree of damage was me needing more of that software update. And still, I mean, it's been 5 years since I've worked with you, and I mean, I'm still in the member circle. I'm still in the healing circle, in that it's a practice. And I think when you've shared like your triggers and your issues, I think that's why people relate so much, because they're like, wow, she knows it all and still has times where she's not going to show up in the way that she wants to show up, right?
Oh gosh, yeah. And I even just want to go back and highlight too, because the beauty, right, that you're kind of describing, because some of us, I think, have had this, again, relational advice given to us, right, where these proclamations, right, we don't go to bed angry. And you're beautifully illustrating that doesn't actually apply to everyone. For some people, an overnight sleep is exactly what that individual needs to be able to regulate, to then be able to take accountability or show up responsibly in a grounded conversation. So again, we just continue to emphasize, I want to continue to emphasize the individuality of each of us, right? Because some of us might be in that situation where what I want or need is not in alignment with what the other person wants or needs. And it, again, to have grounded conversations, both people have to be committed and in that grounded state. And that's why relationships are generally so complicated, which then for me, most of the things that still activate me are very acutely present within relationships, right? Those are the moments. And it very much maps on to, and I can see the patterning for me, typically when I'm not, and this is why I emphasize, even though course, How to Be the Love You Seek is very much a relational book, as most of my work, so much of the foundational relationship that we talk about is the relationship to self.
Exactly.
Because for me, these moments of activation or of triggers, whatever we want to call them, become much more frequent in my day, in my life, when I'm not in active care of myself, when days have gone, right, where I'm not doing the things I need to do in the morning, where I'm not staying attentive and conscious to myself throughout the day, when I'm not taking moments to regulate or pause or get energy out in a more kind of, you know, movement way, whatever it is for me, because those are the moments. And again, applying this back to the stress conversation, the more my stress is going up and I'm not tolerating it or coping with it in a way that allows me to stay grounded, the more likely then those triggers are for me, not only going to be present, because for a lot of us, and again, I want to, if anyone has the expectation that awareness of a trigger removes them, absolutely not. They will still be present, right? That peace is still there. I can now see everything happening. And I even sometimes catch myself. I'm like floating in action saying, why are you saying this? No, you know, and I'm still saying it, right? So they don't go away, and I'm being silly now, but that's the reality, right? And the moments where I'm not going to be able to not say it is when I haven't been taking care of myself, when I'm already overwhelmed by stress. So and then true. I do say or do the thing that is the old habit that I want to avoid. So I'm always willing, and I always have ample, you know, teaching moments to share, because again, these habits and patterns, this is why so many of us have been stuck for so long. Even those of us who have had the access and resources to support, you know, supportive explorations like therapy and awareness building and read all the books, because it's the action of actually breaking these habits in the moment, which for a lot of us, again, bringing this beautifully full circle, means teaching ourselves how to be with our emotions in a different way, how to be with someone else's emotions and perspectives in a different way, so that in those moments, we can actually create a new habit that then is not just one and done. We need to repeat over time. So all of this is connected, right? I can only show up as grounded as I feel. Mm-hmm. My activators and triggers are always going to be there, at least for the foreseeable future, until I create some new pathways where they don't need to be relied on anymore, which for a lot of us takes time.
Time. Yes. And with that, so let's talk about the self-healer circle, because I know there's a wait list and you don't enroll. I mean, I'm never leaving, because even I think what's so beautiful about it is you continue to add so much. I mean, just 2 weeks ago, I jumped in on, it was like a live on codependency, right? And I'm like, the fact that we have this kind of access to you, and I'm imagining that as things come up, you're like, let's teach it, you know, or hey, someone's mentioned this in the comments, let's bring something. So talk a little bit about that. When are you enrolling again? And what does it all include?
I'm smiling now, Amy, because this month, we're actually, the topic is inner teen. And it was a direct request from members several months ago. And that's the beautiful thing about the circle is I have somewhat an idea, and I'll tell a little bit about it in terms of the courses or the topics. It's very much an active interface between the community and kind of the creation of these courses. So this month is a direct request from just topics and conversations and points of struggle that was reflected in the community. So the circle itself was born out of the time together when we were working. And at the same time that I was doing all this holistic learning, I was also really learning and leaning into community-based healing models and really seeing that in my field, there wasn't much. If you didn't have access to that one helping professional or that one therapist to see, like, there was no other place for you to go. And I was also hearing overwhelmingly from the community that was, you know, being created on Instagram, and even many clients I was seeing, of people who wanted other community, who wanted to be in a group of people who were thinking about the same things, who were, you know, on the same journey, who were looking for a different type of relationship. Because I think the byproduct of healing for a lot of us is, if I really want to simplify it, change. And where a lot of us then experience changes within our relationships.
Right.
And so the idea was really born out of very much like interest, desire, even of myself. I saw a lot of change in a lot of long-term relationships. Some I thought I would keep forever. And now I was really wanting a group of people who just like got it, who spoke the same language, who were thinking about the same things, who were, you know, making similar choices. I was starting to be kind of a weird person. I go to bed very early. I wake up very early. Like, my social life was starting to like look different than what society looks. So I was wanting to simply fit in a different way with a different group of people. So the idea for a community-driven model that is now the self-healer circle was born, which very much is community-driven. Now we've been able to invest a lot in terms of technology that it very much mimics, though it's away from social media. It's completely housed on our own private website, though every member gets their own profile that they can use as they want. Some members don't use it at all. Some members, you know, picture of themselves. And within that, they can interact with members from literally around the world. Where? We have a members map now as one of our new integrated pieces, which is so cool. I mean, sometimes I just go in there, Amy, and just look at all around the world. You can see all these pins from members joining. A lot of members, though, use that to connect with other members in real life in their communities to, you know, develop relationships even outside of the circle. And then, of course, every month, as I mentioned, a new course comes up. It's very much an active conversation in terms of what we're thinking about. There's PDF type resources. Now, at this point, because interaction and community interaction, in addition to learning, is such a part of the circle at least once a week now. We have a 4 to 5 events every month, whether it's topic-based events, workshops, Q&As with me, community check-ins where Jenna and I, the co-creator, and I, we sit there and we kind of just like hang out and talk about our own healing journey within the community. And so whether or not you're coming to those events, as some members do, for the information, or whether or not you're coming to those events to interact with the other members, because there's a live chat, you know, that's in action on those. So for me, it's just, it's such a point of, it's a space that I had always, you know, dreamt and wanted for myself. So to be and see and experience it as a living, breathing entity, for me, it's just so overwhelming. And I'm so proud of what it is, what it's becoming, of the team that, you know, supports it behind the scenes, and how it really is. It's a life. It's an entity. It's a beautiful community. And I'm just so inspired by the humans that are in it.
Oh, I love that. And I think, you know, it's such a cost-effective thing for people, you know, to use. That's the other thing too, is, you know, therapy can be expensive. And there's a lot of, if I look at how many years I've needed to work at this, I'd be broke if I was going to these like one-to-one sessions. Yet this is even more than any therapist can give you in the time that they see you. So if you're listening, and, you know, I know the enrollment is coming up pretty soon, isn't it?
May 1st.
Get on the wait list and get notified when you can get in there, because there's so much to be offered in there. And I would recommend anyone. And then, of course, your books. I actually think that How to Be the Love You Seek should be the first one. I love How to Do the Work, don't get me wrong. But now that I see the reverse, I think this is where more people need so much help. And, you know, like you said, until you love yourself, you're really not going to show up for yourself in the full capacity that you can. I mean, I see it in fat loss all the time, but I'm like, listen, if we don't get the self-love first, you may grunt and grind yourself there short term, but you will continue to sabotage. Whereas now it's a form of self-love, is eating healthy and exercising. We start to see it not as punishment, but as like reward, you know?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's just such a part of it too, is it's the core and how we feel about ourselves, whether it's, you know, how we look, you know, it's so reflective. Totally. In, like you said, we can put back to this idea, like surface, right? We can put band-aids on things for only so long, right? Because if at our core, right, we don't, and again, I, even just now I can even offer a version of maybe an expanded definition of love. If we even just start with acceptance, right, before we get to, because I think love feels overwhelming and threatening for a lot of us who are on the complete end of the spectrum and loathing of the self, right? So if we can just take a miniature step, and, you know, acceptance begins not with immediately having acceptance-based loving thoughts. It begins with just removing our attention from the negative critical thoughts that will still be there. Yes. And then consistently practicing that, though, again, at our core, I just think, and I just want to thank you for the gift that you continue to give all of the clients that you work with, in terms of the depth of knowing. And I'm as on a personal note, I'm just going to selfishly take a moment and just share with you, because I've been waiting to do this, just how inspired I am. From the moment I met you and working together, Amy, you've just had such a part of my heart, and just watching you continue to do and to impact those that you're impacting, it's very meaningful. So just thank you for being who you are.
And honestly, it goes the same way. There's not one person that's been more pivotal in my own journey. And it's like why I want to share it with everyone. So this means so much. You're just so down to earth with everything. And I know people that are listening, they see you online. And like, I mean, anyone I said that I was having on, they're like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm done. I'm like, she's just so genuine and authentic with what you share. And the impact that you have, I mean, just on my own family is, it's priceless. I can't even put anything on it. So I thank you for being here and for helping me heal and go through the journey. And I'm excited for everyone to listen to this one. Thank you, Nicole.
Oh gosh. Thank you for having me. Thank you for gifting me with your time again, and with exposure to your community. And again, just thank you for you, truly.
Thank you so much, Nicole. This was so great. I mean, definitely on my big list of wanting to,
I have to say, I don't think I've ever had an emotional moment like this. So this was a first. Aww. So I truly, Amy, you're very special.
It's
it's invaluable. I mean, honestly, this last time when we went to Mexico, I don't know if I could have dealt with like my own parent guilt if I had not gone through a lot of your work. And my kids, you're saving my 25-year-old who's been through a lot. It was really hard to hear some of that stuff. And I think I would have been like my mom. I would have been like, I'm not going to let, you know, like, I've worked so hard to, you know, have you and raise you. And instead I listened and I really just went, you know what? He's hurting inside. I have to give him some space for that. So thank you. I will, you know, be sharing this. Take care.
Love to all of you. Yes.
Yes. Thank you so much. I'll have a good day. Okay.
You too. You too.
Bye. Hey.
Hello. Hello. Oh
I'm so excited for this. Wow. You have no idea.
You have no idea. I've been waiting for you to ask me for this to happen. Thank you for all the flexibility. I know I had a hiccup myself last week, so I've been counting. I've just been looking forward to reconnecting with you. How the hell are you?
I'm doing really good. You want to come say hi? I've got like a family that's dying to see you because you're like a celebrity.
I love it. Oh, hi, Eric. How are you?
Great. Nice to meet you.
So good to meet you. Well, I feel like I know you, but so nice to meet you, I guess, officially.
I'm pretty pumped about this. So.
Yeah. And then my daughter, she like wanted to make, she requested the day off so that she could come say hi.
Hi.
Hi, hi. So nice to officially meet you too. I've heard so much about you. I know so much about you.
Seeing you like, like you're real.
I'm real. I'm real. Well, I honestly feel like I'm the special. I'm of the special occasion today because I've been looking forward to connect with your mom for so long. I'm just so inspired by everything, Amy. So I'm super excited myself to be here.
Well, I told everybody at work that this was happening.
I know.
Everybody's looking forward to it.
Yeah. It's been my, well, cool. Well, thank you guys.
All right.
Okay, I'm on a mission. As you know, if you've been following along, I have a goal to be a top 100 podcast. And it's less about that top 100 and more about, I want to make an impact. I want more people to hear Eff It and learn from all the mistakes that I've made, along with me bringing on really special guests for you. So my ask here is this. I want you to screenshot this episode today and share it on your social media. Share it with a friend. You know, tag me in it. Go give me a review. You, of course, if you're really feeling it, and rate me. You know, this is the only way things are going to get seen here. And in a big world of tons and tons of podcasts, I'm hoping that you're going to choose mine and help me on my mission.